My Bondage and My Freedom by Frederick Douglass. Chapter 23. Introduced to the Abolitionists. In the summer of 1841, a grand anti-slavery convention was held in Nantucket under the auspices of Mr. Garrison and his friends. Until now, I had taken no holiday since my escape from slavery, having worked very hard that spring and summer in Richmond's brass foundry, sometimes working all night as well as all day, and needing a day or two of rest. I attended this convention, never supposing that I should take part in the proceedings. Indeed, I was not aware that anyone connected with the convention even so much as knew my name. I was, however, quite mistaken. Mr. William C. Coffin, a prominent abolitionist in those days of trial, had heard me speaking to my colored friends in the little schoolhouse on 2nd Street, New Bedford, where we worshipped. He sought me out in the crowd and invited me to say a few words to the convention. Thus sought out and thus invited, I was induced to speak out the feelings inspired by the occasion and the fresh recollection of the scenes through which I had passed as a slave. My speech on this occasion is about the only one I ever made of which I do not remember a single connected sentence. It was with the utmost difficulty that I could stand erect, or that I could command and articulate two words without hesitation and stammering. I trembled in every limb. I am not sure that my embarrassment was not the most effective part of my speech, if speech it could be called. At any rate, this is about the only part of my performance that I now distinctly remember. But excited and convulsed as I was, the audience, though remarkably quiet before, became as much excited as myself. Mr. Garrison followed me, taking me as his text, and now, whether I had made an eloquent speech in behalf of freedom or not, his was one never to be forgotten by those who heard it. Those who had heard Mr. Garrison oftenest, and had known him longest, were astonished. It was an effort of unequaled power, sweeping down like a very tornado every opposing barrier, whether of sentiment or opinion. For a moment he possessed that almost fabulous inspiration often referred to but seldom attained, in which a public meeting is transformed, as it were, into a single individuality, the orator wielding 1,000 hearts and heads at once, and by the simple majesty of his all-controlling thought, converting his hearers into the express image of his own soul. That night there were at least 1,000 Garrisonians in Nantucket. At the close of this great meeting, I was duly waited on by Mr. John A. Collins, then the general agent of the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society, and urgently solicited by him to become an agent of that society, and to publicly advocate its anti-slavery principles. I was reluctant to take the proffered position. I had not been quite 3 years from slavery, was honestly distrustful of my ability, wished to be excused, publicity exposed me to discovery and arrest by my master, and other objections came up. But Mr. Collins was not to be put off, and I finally consented to go out for 3 months, for I supposed that I should have got to the end of my story and my usefulness in that length of time. Here opened upon me a new life, a life for which I had had no preparation. I was a graduate from the peculiar institution, Mr. Collins used to say when introducing me, with my diploma written on my back. The 3 years of my freedom had been spent in the hard school of adversity. My hands had been furnished by nature with something like a solid leather coating, and I had bravely marked out for myself a life of rough labor suited to the hardness of my hands as a means of supporting myself and rearing my children. Now, what shall I say of this 14 years' experience as a public advocate of the cause of my enslaved brothers and sisters? The time is but as a speck, yet large enough to justify a pause for retrospection, and a pause it must only be. Young, ardent, and hopeful, I entered upon this new life in the full gush of unsuspecting enthusiasm. The cause was good. The men engaged in it were good. The means to attain its triumph good. Heaven's blessing must attend all, and freedom must soon be given to the pining millions under a ruthless bondage. My whole heart went with the holy cause, and my most fervent prayer to the Almighty Disposer of the hearts of men were continually offered for its early triumph. Who, or what, thought I, can withstand a cause so good, so holy, so indescribably glorious? The God of Israel is with us. the might of the Eternal is on our side. Now let but the truth be spoken, and a nation will start forth at the sound. In this enthusiastic spirit, I dropped into the ranks of freedom's friends and went forth to the battle. For a time I was made to forget that my skin was dark and my hair crisped. For a time I regretted that I could not have shared the hardships and dangers endured by the earlier workers for the slave's release. I soon, however, found that my enthusiasm had been extravagant, that hardships and dangers were not yet past, and that the life now before me had shadows as well as sunbeams. Among the first duties assigned me on entering the ranks was to travel in company with Mr. George Foster to secure subscribers to the Anti-Slavery Standard and the Liberator. With him I traveled and lectured through the eastern counties of Massachusetts. Much interest was awakened. Large meetings assembled. Many came, no doubt, from curiosity to hear what a Negro could say in his own cause. I was generally introduced as a chattel, a thing, a piece of Southern property, the chairman assuring the audience that it could speak. Fugitive slaves at that time were not so plentiful as now, and as a fugitive slave lecturer I had the advantage of being a brand new fact, the first one out. Up to that time a colored man was deemed a fool who confessed himself a runaway slave, not only because of the danger to which he exposed himself of being retaken, but because it was a confession of a very low origin. Some of my colored friends in New Bedford thought very badly of my wisdom for thus exposing and degrading myself. The only precaution I took at the beginning to prevent Master Thomas from knowing where I was and what I was about was the withholding my former name, my master's name, and the name of the state and county from which I came. During the first 3 or 4 months, my speeches were almost exclusively made up of narrations of my own personal experience as a slave. "Let us have the facts," said the people. So also said friend George Foster, who always wished to pin me down to my simple narrative. "Give us the facts," said Collins. "We will take care of the philosophy." Just here arose some embarrassment. It was impossible for me to repeat the same old story month after month and to keep up my interest in it. It was new to the people, it is true, but it was an old story to me, and to go through with it night after night was a task altogether too mechanical for my nature. "Tell your story, Frederick," would whisper my then revered friend, William Lloyd Garrison, as I stepped upon the platform. I could not always obey, for I was now reading and thinking. New views of the subject were presented to my mind. It did not entirely satisfy me to narrate wrongs. I felt like denouncing them. I could not always curb my moral indignation for the perpetrators of slaveholding villainy long enough for a circumstantial statement of the facts, which I felt almost everybody must know. Besides, I was growing and needed room. "People won't believe you ever was a slave, Frederick, if you keep on this way," said Fred Foster. "Be yourself," said Collins, "and tell your story." It was said to me, "Better have a little of the plantation manner of speech than not. 'Tis not best that you seem too learned." These excellent friends were actuated by the best of motives, and were not altogether wrong in their advice, and still I must speak just the word that seemed to me the word to be spoken by me. At last the apprehended trouble came. People doubted if I had ever been a slave. They said I did not talk like a slave, look like a slave, nor act like a slave, and that they believed I had never been south of Mason and Dixon's line. "He don't tell us where he came from, what his master's name was, how he got away, nor the story of his experience. Besides, he is educated, and is in this a contradiction of all the facts we have concerning the ignorance of the slaves." Thus I was in a pretty fair way to be denounced as an impostor. The committee of the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society knew all the facts in my case and agreed with me in the prudence of keeping them private. They therefore never doubted my being a genuine fugitive, but going down the aisles of the churches in which I spoke and hearing the free-spoken Yankees saying repeatedly, "He's never been a slave, I'll warrant ye," I resolved to dispel all doubt at no distant day by such a revelation of facts as could not be made by any other than a genuine fugitive. In a little less than 4 years, therefore, after becoming a public lecturer, I was induced to write out the leading facts connected with my experience in slavery, giving names of persons, places, and dates, thus putting it in the power of any who doubted to ascertain the truth or falsehood of my story of being a fugitive slave. This statement soon became known in Maryland, and I had reason to believe that an effort would be made to recapture me. It is not probable that any open attempt to secure me as a slave could have succeeded, further than the obtainment by my master of the money value of my bones and sinews. Fortunately for me, in the 4 years of my labors in the abolition cause, I had gained many friends who would have suffered themselves to be taxed to almost any extent to save me from slavery. It was felt that I had committed the double offense of running away and exposing the secrets and crimes of slavery and slaveholders. There was a double motive for seeking my re-enslavement, avarice and vengeance, and while, as I have said, there was little probability of successful recapture if attempted openly, I was constantly in danger of being spirited away at a moment when my friends could render me no assistance. In traveling about from place to place, often alone, I was much exposed to this sort of attack. Anyone cherishing the design to betray me could easily do so by simply tracing my whereabouts through the anti-slavery journals, for my meetings and movements were promptly made known in advance. My true friends, Mr. Garrison and Mr. Phillips, had no faith in the power of Massachusetts to protect me and my right to liberty. Public sentiment and the law, in their opinion, would hand me over to the tormentors. Mr. Phillips especially considered me in danger, and said, when I showed him the manuscript of my story, if in my place he would throw it into the fire. Thus, the reader will observe, the settling of one difficulty only opened the way for another, and that though I had reached a free state and had obtained position for public usefulness, I was still tormented with the liability of losing my liberty. How this liability was dispelled will be related with other incidents in the next chapter. The end of Chapter 23 of My Bondage and My Freedom by Frederick Douglass. Read by Rick Kistner for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.